for admission of Heather A. Whipple versus the Board of Bar Examiners. Mr. Dan Sipman of Folia Larda will speak first, representing the petitioner, Ms. Whipple.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I'm here because I believe Heather Whipple, seated directly to my right behind me, deserves to be admitted to our bar. I believe that she was treated unfairly in this process and that she deserves to be my colleague and not my client here today. I believe that what happened was unfair really in all respects, on the merits, procedurally, and the result was too harsh. And I'm going to touch on those. There's really four issues. The main issue, of course, is whether Heather has satisfied the requirements of fitness and character to join us as members of the bar. The three collateral issues I want to touch on are the standards of review that govern this proceeding today, whether Heather was denied due process in the handling of the hearing, and then thirdly, whether the result that occurred here was far too harsh and that she is barred permanently from seeking admission. I want to start with the standards of review, because that's where the court, of course, starts. The board here seeks to change this court's longstanding precedent on what the standards should be as to conclusions of law and mixed law fact determinations. Most recently articulated by this court in the Rush decision, the standard is de novo. We believe it should stay that way. The board submits two arguments for asking this court to change the standard of review. First, the board argues that the Rush determination by this court was a mistake, an aberration, and wasn't supported by any prior authority. And secondly, the board argues that it's bad law and should be overturned in any event. We submit there's three good reasons why that argument, or both those arguments, fail. First is Rush isn't an aberration. It, in fact, is consistent with longstanding authority of this court. That authority was marshaled by Chief Justice Abrahamson just 2 months before the Rush decision in her dissent in the Altshuler case. Her dissent was on an issue unrelated to the standard of review, but there she marshaled the prior law of this court that would indicate that review of a board determination that's a conclusion of law or a mixed law fact determination should remain and always has been de novo. Secondly, it's not bad law. It's the same standard that this court applies in reviewing all agency decisions. The board, I think, is simply incorrect. What it misses is the distinction between the types of decisions being reviewed. Whereas here, we're looking at SCR 40.06, it's a mandatory criteria that's being applied by the agency here, the board. Review should be, and always has been, de novo as to all agency determinations. Judge Gardsky, or former Judge Gardsky, in his leading treatise, Wisconsin Rules of Appellate Standards of Review, points out this very distinction and says that review by this court of all agency decisions where it involves a mandatory determination should be de novo. Here, the determination is under SCR 40.06. The board, quote, shall certify. That's different than in Altshuler, where the issue was whether the board may waive the diploma privilege. And that's a distinction that's with a difference. The third and really fundamental reason why the board's argument on changing the standard of review should fail is that it ignores this court's special role and expertise in matters of the bar. This court has repeatedly described itself as having that special expertise. It's an inherent part of its functions here is to regulate admission, discipline, and really all aspects of the bar. It's different than in reviewing, for instance, like a PSC determination. There might be technical expertise on the commission that this court arguably might lack. Here, this court is as good or certainly better, in our view, than any commission member in evaluating the character and fitness qualification issue. Now, even as to, so that deals with of law and mixed law and fact issue. Even as to the pure findings of fact here, we think they should be reviewed de novo. Why? Because as the board admits in the first page of its brief, where the findings are premised solely on documentary evidence and don't involve disputed issues of fact testimony, that's appropriate. Here, the only sworn testimony was by Heather Ripple's witnesses at the hearing. It was 100% uniformly favorable. It did not create any disputed issue of fact. the sole, and it was never even mentioned in the board's decision, the sole thing mentioned by the board in its decision was from the written record. And again, under its own citation of authority, which we also marshal, that's de novo. Finally, before turning to substance, we think this whole standard of review issue shouldn't carry the day, because under any standard here, even the most deferential standard, this decision fails.
I ask two questions. As I understand it, there have not been evidentiary hearings in the past in these matters. There was an evidentiary hearing here. Should that affect the standard of review?
Let me answer it this way, Your Honor. Is this, the SCR does provide for a mechanism for handling or having such evidentiary hearings. It's my information that there have been hearings in the past. Maybe those particular proceedings haven't come before this court, but this wasn't a novel matter in that sense.
Do you have a case in mind?
As I said, I'm not aware of a published decision where the issue of an evidentiary hearing was discussed by...
Well, 40.081 says, or is it 2, the board shall grant a hearing only upon a showing that there are facts bearing on the applicant's case that cannot be presented in writing. The board shall not grant a hearing on its decision on waiver under SCR 40.10. So is this the hearing that you're under?
The chronology here was there was a set of recommendations by the board's administrative director. Those were adopted essentially in whole. There was then a period of a year leading up to the final decision. In between there was this evidentiary hearing. At that hearing, we submited, I think it was 8 or 9 sworn affidavits and the testimony of 3 witnesses, Judge DeChambeau, Phyllis Schwann, or Solomon, I'm sorry, who was an employer, and Ms. Ripple herself testified. The board introduced no evidence, no witnesses, nothing at this hearing. The hearing took roughly an afternoon.
Well, and the report of Dr. Spear, or Spire, however you say that, was critical. And I would have liked to see him testify. Whose responsibility would it have been to put him on as a witness?
That's a good question, Your Honor, and really goes to the procedural due process issue that was a problem here. Is we were required to pay for his original report and did. Part of the written understanding and agreement was we would be copied on communications and reports by Dr. Spear, so we had an understanding of what it was he was reporting. We got a copy of the first report. We felt it was largely supportive of Heather, and we decided to proceed in reliance upon her treating physician, Dr. Nielsen, who did put in a sworn affidavit, which was not equivocal, and which reached the ultimate issue of her qualifications to practice law. At the hearing, questions came out from the board members that surprised us because they said, well, Dr. Spear said such and such, Mr. Van Sicklin. What do you think about that? And I said, well, that's not in his report. I don't know what you're talking about. And it came out that there was a second secret report that we were never given before the hearing. Had we known about that, clearly we would have subpoenaed him in or asked to go to him and provide him with a full record. The reason I say that, Your Honor, is that in his report, he identifies one, he says, I'm not competent to really address this issue, but nevertheless, you've asked me to because my first report didn't reach the issue. I find that she's capable of working independently and being reliable in employment, but you still want me to identify 12 factors, so I will. And 8 of those 12, he gave Heather, you know, unblemished support. On 4 of them, he had a mixed review. On the positive, he said, well, I understand that her employer, an attorney named Phyllis Schwann here in town, trusted her, gave her keys, let her handle money, and so forth. And so I give a lot of credence to the fact that one person evidently trusted Heather in her employment. What he didn't know, of course, was that we had all these other witnesses that had also worked with Heather, and we would have introduced that evidence, and we believe that the only fair reading of the second report is that he would have changed his views or even softened them. But even what it is, we don't think is bad. What happened then is the board was visibly, I think, concerned that we have been denied due process and required Mr. Rankin, the administrator, to send it to us after the hearing and to comment on it, which is what we did. But at that point, we didn't have the chance to...
If you had had both reports from Dr. Spear, would it have been your burden then to call him if you wanted him as a witness?
That's a good question, because it goes to what's really fairly within the record here. Unsworn reports, unauthenticated by a witness that weren't even really moved into evidence for the like of the hearing, or the sworn submissions that we proceeded with, and how do you weigh those? It'd be a matter of trial strategy, but I clearly probably would have subpoenaed him in because I know Dr. Spear. I think he would have been fair, and had he had the whole picture here, it would have been support. That's just not the way it shook out. Our concern was to ask the board to step back and start over. It would have moved this whole process back. I have a client that's now 3.5 years out of law school, being judged largely on her juvenile record. She's a 30-year-old adult woman, and I didn't want to further delay this process by stepping back 6 months, a year.
Counsel, may I just to correct either my misconception or when you say judged on her juvenile record, my perception was that the occurrences were from the time she was 18 over, some of the transgressions. So, and I was looking at the synopsis here that the things that at least I looked at were not primarily juvenile.
Let's touch on that, Your Honor. I think in the last 10 years, I think it's probably since she turned 21, there are six things that I could identify.
Did she turn 21 or 18?
Yeah, let's take 21 and then I'll go from the juvenile back, because there's two groups here. But if we just take the last decade, okay, from 21.
And I wasn't debating this, I just wanted to clarify that.
And then there were several that happened in this window of 18 to 21. But just to go through those, in the last 10 years, she had six things that arguably appear in this record that would be negative. And I think none of those add up to more than a house of cards. She had some parking tickets while a student. She got a ticket for an ordinance violation. She had a tuition bill at an out-of-state private school that she didn't fully pay, left $600 balance on it. She was accused by the board of fleeing work because of unemployment, because of stress during this 10 years. She was faulted for seeing Dr. Nielsen, the UW psychiatrist, for counseling and for having Prozac prescribed. And finally, she was faulted because she acknowledged to Dr. Spear that on occasion, as an undergraduate, she drank to excess. That's the sum total of those six things. Let's go through them. Parking. It's undisputed she paid all these parking tickets. If anybody's spending time on the UW campus, a person that was working full-time to support themselves, had community activities, was a managing editor of the Law Review, and got through in 3 years, it's darn hard not to get occasional parking tickets. It came up in the context of Dr. Spear pressing her. Anything else you should tell me? Anything else in your entire life that could be faulted? She said, unfortunately, made a cavalier remark about, yeah, I got enough parking tickets to wallpaper a wall of my apartment.
Counsel, I don't mean to take your time, because what jumped out at me when I read this was... in 1991, she was convicted of misdemeanor theft, and I just said, well, it's now 2001, so that's 10 years ago.
Okay.
And she's 30, so she would have been allegedly 20 at that time. I'm not debating this.
I just want to go through it because I do want to touch on those things, including the theft, to put them in context. Because
it's not that she got parking tickets. I gather it's that she didn't think that they were very significant in life. Not being willing to obey the law. Isn't that the point about the parking tickets?
I think the fact that she paid them all promptly, there's no evidence of even how many tickets there were, whether we're talking about
enough
two
to
or
pay
10.
For a wall.
It was an unfortunate comment, but if it was really significant, presumably there'd be some proof about how many or that she didn't pay them. I think the fact that she paid them promptly and explained the remark in her testimony is significant. Seeing Dr. Nielsen, I'm sorry, the tuition bill, you know, she paid a large amount to go to a private out-of-state college. She paid all but $600. She wasn't aware of the balance. When she applied to get her transcript, she found out that she owed $600 and paid it. That happened before the hearing and is undisputed. Next, Dr. Nielsen, yes, she saw counseling, but that's appropriate. That's a good thing. I don't think this court wants to send a message to law students they shouldn't seek help when they need it. I think she should be commended, and Dr. Nielsen reported that it was helpful and dealt with the problem. Finally, the college drinking. Dr. Spear's own report acknowledges that it's never been a problem in her life. No one's ever claimed it was a problem. All she did was say she drank to excess as an undergraduate on occasion.
You skipped over the spontaneous vacations.
Yeah. Let's talk about the claim of fleeing for stress. She left, the two instances are, she left the first semester, at the end of her first semester, while in good standing from the law school at Washington University because she had been assaulted. The male student who had committed that act was expelled from school. That's undisputed. She didn't just run away mid-semester. She completed her semester in good academic standing, transferred to the UW, and finished up in 3 years. The other instance about fleeing on vacation, she took 3 vacations. We're talking about a 6-year period here. No employer ever claimed it was a problem. Every employer that came in and testified, every affidavit, was uniformly glowing. So I think that's just, a red herring. Now let's talk about Justice Wilcox's question. There were 4 other things in her life that the board complained about. One was this misdemeanor theft conviction when she was like 18 or 19, somewhere in there. It was for a $7 bracelet of a roommate. It was expunged from her record, and she voluntarily reported it on her application, even though I think arguably she didn't have to. Before that, what we're talking about is an incident when she was an A&W car hop in high school, where some money blew off her table or her tray when she was walking back to the area. Somehow the board twists this into a cash drawer discrepancy, that she was terminated while on probation, while there's no evidence she was ever on probation then, or that she was convicted or fired or anything like that. Some instance about when she was age 13, Mr. Ballesteri argues about in his brief at page 8. Again, if you look at the actual record where he cites, it doesn't say what he says it does. But in any event, if we're going to be judged for something we did when we were 13 years old, I just think that's inappropriate. And you look at VA 6.03, lays out the criteria of what the board and this court should look at in weighing acts of prior conduct. The very first thing that should be weighed is the applicant's age at the time of the prior conduct. The next thing is the recency of the conduct. And the third thing is the reliability of the information. And the fourth is the seriousness. And then the next is what's happened since. I think every one of those factors weighs heavily in favor of Heather here. Again, whether it was when she was 18 or 17 or 19, the one incident of a $7 theft that was expunged, a misdemeanor, it is not the sort of thing that should bar a 30-year-old adult woman who has excelled in her life since.
Counsel, and again, I thought there were 2 incidents. One was petty theft, and then there was an incident, alleged theft while she was babysitting, and then she was allegedly on a deferred prosecution, and she allegedly was dropped from that for a failure to cooperate. Am I mistaken?
No, I think there is some evidence that, Your Honor. What's the evidence in the babysitting incident is disputed. What's undisputed, she's never charged or convicted of anything. And the other point on the delayed prosecution is her record was expunged. I mean, she served it out while working full-time, while going to school full-time.
That was in connection with the misdemeanor theft in college, the roommate issue?
Yeah.
Mr. Van Sicklin, let's assume for a minute that there is enough here that the board could reasonably be troubled about whether or not she meets the requirements for character and fitness. Do you know of any precedent for admitting someone to practice with some monitoring, with some kind of guidelines or monitoring or safety features, if you will?
Let me answer that in two ways. Personally, I'm not aware of or program. Many employers, our law firm, for instance, has a mentoring arrangement, but it's not judicially ordered. But it's just a practical way employers deal with, starting lawyers. So that occurs, I think, in the real world. To also address your question, maybe indirectly, is at the end of my reply brief, I marshaled the cases and talk about other situations where this court has overturned the board's penalty. And in those cases, for instance, matter of Gaylord, every one of those cases involves situations far more egregious than this, far more recent in time than this. And what this court held in all three of those cases is that the applicant should be given a probationary year period and then allowed to apply and be admitted if during that year it was good behavior. But the year period should be measured retroactively back to when the board made its decision. Well, here, we're past a year. There's nothing in her record here. She's been 3.5 years out of law school with good conduct. Matter of Gaylord, Your Honor, that was a person who was convicted, felony criminal convictions, concealed weapon, possession of cocaine, DWI, driving with a license revocated. This court held 1 year probation measured from the time of the decision. So I think that speaks to your question. And then finally, I think probably the most important thing that speaks to your question is we have almost 9 years of employers coming in testifying, saying, we've worked with this woman. We've worked with her in law-related jobs, in jobs that are high stress, financial, integrity important, confidentiality important. Every one of those employers is very pleased. If I just might indulge myself and meet the court with reading Judge DeChambeau's testimony, sworn testimony live at the hearing, just a highlight starting at A117 of my appendix. He talks a little bit about his background, how he's known Heather, and how he recommended Heather for employment by the Metzner firm. He says, I've had contact with Heather for a number of years. The first contact I had with Heather, she was assigned through a law school program as a judicial clerkship. I've had, over the last 14 years, probably 25 law students who have participated in this program with me, and she ranks near the top, if not the top, of all the students I've had and the quality of work that she does. The problems that Heather has had in the past seem to be, to me, to be negligible. I think she is a fine young woman, and as I said, I have enough confidence in her that if she would accept the meager stipend that I would be able to provide her, I would give her a job in a flash. This is a judge, he interestingly was the judge that dealt with Heather on the theft misdemeanor conviction. And he's also the judge that recommended Heather, after working with her, to his fellow judges. She's presently serving in a non-legal role as a clerk over the Dane County Circuit Court for two other judges as a record, all with full knowledge of the facts before you. She was also hired by Ms. Solomon, who testified live at the hearing, with full knowledge of these facts. And again, so I think she has been monitored in that sense, or, her real-life world conduct has been looked at, scrutinized with knowledge of these facts for a number of years.
How do you get to be managing editor of the UW Law Review?
Well, at least when I was there and on the Law Review, it was done in two ways. Some people were moved on purely on the basis of grade point average, and then there's an election within the members, and then other people's are specially moved on by a writing sample they submit. And I don't recall offhand which it was with Heather, although she had very good grades and won a, what's called a Law Merit Scholarship. And again, I have children, and I give them all the support in the world. I pay their tuition. This is a woman that did this full-time working, community service as a volunteer, earned all these accolades. It's a person that doesn't flee stress, that's, incapable of dealing with stress and performing. I think that's just, there's no reasonable way the fact record here can be construed. And I think this court should review the documentary evidence for itself. Dr. Spear's report, they can quote every snippet they want out of there. Most of those snippets came from their private investigator, Mr. Pace. They don't come from real facts. It's just hearsay upon hearsay. They say, well, we're summarizing Dr. Spear's report and their decision. If you actually look, he's got like pages of sort of background stuff, and at the end he has a conclusion. It's largely favorable to Heather. Can work independently, is a reliable employee. Nowhere does he say that she's incapable of being a lawyer. To the contrary, in a supplemental report, when the board pushed him, he said, I'm not even competent to make that decision. That's really up to, I submit, lawyers, judges.
What about the fact of the second decision of the board after the hearing was virtually identical to the first decision? What do you think we should say about that?
I think it's a fundamental violation of due process and this court's holding in the Childs case. The Childs case was based on U.S. Supreme Court precedent, which says basically when you go to one of these hearings on bar admission, the board must consider, evaluate the evidence submitted. There is no indication of any consideration whatsoever. All they did is change the date and the numbering. The wording is identical. And what's really troubling about that, Your Honor, is there were some facts that beyond cavil were just wrong in the original decision. And we pointed that out. You would think they would at least take the moment or two to correct the factual mistakes.
What were those factual mistakes?
Our brief goes through them at long length, but like the A&W car hop instance, even in their brief, Mr. Ballesteri acknowledges that there are four instances in which the board decision overstates or exaggerates Dr. Spear's report. He says, well, it's kind of harmless there. But it's not harmless when somebody's life and livelihood hangs in the balance. Another instance, I think, is the brief or the decision alleges that she was not forthcoming, and somehow Dr. Spear faulted her for that. And we pointed out in our brief that that's not the case. Dr. Spear found her very cooperative, very forthcoming, given the circumstances that she was, you know, being put through here.
Well, she wouldn't release her juvenile records.
No, not originally. And then when he asked about it, he ultimately decided that he didn't need them. They would be of no assistance to him. So the issue never really got pushed. But originally, I'm sorry, I think I'm out of time here. Just to finish my thought, she was originally concerned because she thought it was incorrect that people would be asking for her personal medical records, that she thought that was an invasion of privacy. But when we got involved as counsel, we talked her through that, and she was very forthcoming. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Van Sippen. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Ballesteri, Assistant Attorney General, representing the Board of Bar Examiners.
Thank you, Your Honor. There's an old saying in the law that if the facts are against you, pound the law. If the law is against you, pound the facts. And if both the law and the facts are against you, pound the table. And I think that's what we've seen a lot of in the briefs that were filed on behalf of Ms. Ripple. There's a lot of pounding on the table. There's a lot of yelling and screaming and saying, the board's unfair, the board did this, the board misrepresented this, the board didn't consider that. And then in his reply brief, Ms. Ripple says, not only did the board do all these nasty things, but the attorney representing the board did all these nasty things. Well, I have double-checked all of my statements of fact in my brief. I have found them to be absolutely accurate. I stand by every single one of them.
You said that she brandished a knife at her parents. Is that a part of the record?
Yes, it is.
I read in the record that she brandished a knife.
Did you read the sentence before that?
Well, I'm sure I did.
Okay. The sentence before that says, there are two incidents involving her parents. In the first of these incidents, she brandished a knife. That's what the record says. Clearly, it's an incident involving her parents. She brandished a knife.
She could brandish a knife without brandishing it at her parents. I mean,
You made it sound as if she threatened her parents.
That's exactly what I, and that's exactly what I think
the record shows.
I'm sorry?
You think that's what the record shows?
Yes, I do.
Mr. Ballastre, I have this correctly. Was there a part of the psychiatric report that your opposing counsel referred to as the secret report that they didn't get, you got, but they didn't get?
Well, I wouldn't call it secret. There is.
I disagree
with the label, but there were two parts of the report. There was the first part of the report, and then there was a supplemental report. Now the board made a mistake, no question about it. We apologize to the court for making that mistake, and that is that we did not give it to Ms. Ripple's attorney in as timely a fashion as we probably should have. But the fact is, we did give it to them.
After
it was not secret.
After the hearing?
No, it was before the hearing.
At the occasion before the first person opened their mouth, but at the
hearing itself.
What about the fact that you cite on page 10, footnote 4, that her parents provided her money for a vacation?
I don't state that as a fact. I state that as a reasonable inference.
What about the vehicle?
Well, the reasonable inference of... where do you get that? What's reasonable about that inference?
Well, who else is going to give her an expensive graduation present?
An aunt, uncle, a grandparent.
I give myself a lot of presents.
you were commenting on everything you have is in the record. I just want to make that clear.
I'm not stating it as a fact.
A present from her parents, and I suppose it's your experience that no one else would give her a gift like that, as we have stated that.
That's correct.
Any other reasonable inferences that you have in the brief?
I'm sure there are lots of reasonable inferences. As far as I'm concerned, every inference I draw is reasonable.
are not supported by facts?
Well, I think this inference is supported by facts.
What facts support that inference?
The fact is that...
paid for her trip. Where what facts?
The fact is, as I stated in the very first sentence, that she took a trip. She said this was a graduation present.
I remember when I graduated from UVA, the day before I went out and bought it to a sports shop, I bought a pile of fly rod for myself, and I called it a graduation present.
Yeah, but she said she got this as a graduation present. That's not... In other places, she says, I spent money to do certain things myself. One of her trips, she says, I had used my savings. This, she says, was a graduation present. She didn't say it was for herself. And like I say, common experience, who's going to give somebody an expensive graduation present other than your parents?
You also indicate she had sufficient support while in law school to enable her to own a 1987 Saab Turbo 9000. Are you inferring that someone was supporting her in law school? Or what do you mean by she had sufficient support?
Well, what I'm saying is that she owned a rather expensive car. I mean, these are not Saab Turbos, are not cheap cars. They're considered luxury cars. She was able to afford that car.
That's what you mean. When you said she had sufficient support, you mean she was able to support herself sufficiently? Is that what you mean?
No, I mean, my inference is that she was getting support from some source that enabled her to buy a very expensive car.
Do you have any facts in the record to suggest that she got money for that car from a source other than her own employment?
Just the fact that it's a very expensive car and the types of jobs that she had, just law clerking for people, were not the kind of jobs that ordinarily enable someone to buy a car that's that expensive.
Well, 87
pot,
I don't know how much all of this costs, but I'll find it.
That's what
On page 18 of your red brief, we've heard from the opposing counsel on the pre post teenage years in the last 10 years. Are these facts, in particular, page 18 of when we had this conviction, which was many years ago, that you say she was caught red-handed, but then that she gave a false name to the police, and this is maybe a city incident, but then gave a name of Jean, and then there was a so-called restraining order. Let's see, she was forced to get a restraining order, the roommate was forced to get a restraining order against her. That's all factual.
Those are all facts in the record, and these occurred while she was in college. The theft incident was from her college roommate. I'm not sure how old she was at the time.
He had to have been under 21 if it was explained.
She was probably under 21, but apparently the theft conviction was as an adult, as far as I can tell. I don't have any absolute source in the record for saying that this was as an adult, but it's a theft conviction. So I have to assume that
if it was as a juvenile, there would be no need to expunge it, right? Because juvenile records are confidential, so we can assume that it was as
I'm sorry, a I didn't hear you.
If it was a juvenile conviction, there would be no need to expunge it.
Right.
So your inference is supported by the law.
That's my inference, that it was a conviction as an adult.
Could I ask you about the evidence at the evidentiary hearing, particularly the report from Dr. Speer? Should he have been present in person to explain some of these somewhat cryptic remarks in his report?
Well, that was a decision that Ms. Ripple's counsel should have made. There's no question that the law is absolutely clear that the burden of persuasion is on the person seeking admission to the bar. And
didn't he respond that he probably would have had the doctor there had he known about the second report?
Well, I understand that the timing was not conducive to having Dr. Speer present at the original evidentiary hearing, but the fact is, there was nothing stopping him from asking for an extension or an adjournment of the evidentiary hearing where he could have presented Dr. Speer as a witness. And I think his own state counsel's own statements before the court today indicate that it was a tactical decision not to ask for an adjournment of the evidentiary hearing because he wanted to get the proceedings rolling due to the time that had elapsed since Ms. Ripple's graduation from law school. But it was clearly his obligation to call witnesses. There's no question about that. The law is very well set for that.
Could you clarify for me, is it the board's position that Ms. Ripple should never be a member of the Wisconsin Bar?
No, I'm glad you brought that up, because that is definitely one of the things that I want to address. The board does not feel that it has the authority to set a date at which a person can reapply once they have been found not fit. There's nothing in the rules that specifically gives them that authority to do that, to say, we're turning you down now, you can reapply in 6 months, or you can reapply in a year. And the little bit of case law that there is on this subject doesn't really answer the question and kind of goes both ways on whether the board has the authority to do this. I will refer first of all to the Chief Justice's dissenting opinion in the Allstreet case. The Chief said in footnote 2 on page 16, referring to the case of the bar admission of Jean Gaylord, in Gaylord, the court reviewed the one-year requirement of SCR 40.09 without submitting the question to the board, even though SCR 40.10 grants the board discretion to waive the one-year requirement. So under that footnote, in a dissenting opinion, and I'm not saying that that was an incorrect statement of the law, but it is just a footnote in a dissenting opinion, the board would apparently have the authority to set a date at which the a rejected applicant could reapply. However, in the Gaylord case itself, at page 828 of that decision, the court said the question of when a person may reapply is a question that the board did not address, and the answer to which lies in the discretion of the court, which seems to suggest that the board doesn't have authority to set a date at which a person can reapply. And that's the reason that no such date appears in the board's decision. It's not because the board has made a determination that Ms. Ripple can never apply for readmission to the bar. It's just that the board doesn't think it has the power to set that date.
Let me ask this. What evidence did the Ripple team fail to put in that would have changed the result? I mean, suppose she applies again. What's going to be different?
Nothing, as far as I know. If she reapplies now under the same circumstances, as far as I know, there's no additional evidence that would be presented by anybody. There's some speculation.
Then I go back to my original question. That was, does the board feel that Heather Ripple should never be a member of the Wisconsin Bar?
The board has taken no position on that. I cannot answer your question because the board has not taken a position, feeling that it is not within the board's authority to take that kind of position. They have totally abstained from that. They've left it to the court to decide. And I think it would be very helpful to the board if the court would address that question in its opinion in this case, and it would clearly decide whether or not the board has authority to make that kind of determination, to make a determination of whether someone can never reapply, which I doubt the board would ever do, but could set a limit on the earliest time that a person could reapply. So the board simply has not addressed that issue, feeling that they have no authority to address that issue.
Mr. Balistrieri? I'm going to be referring to three documents. One is Dr. Spires or Spires' initial report, dated February 26th. The other is the affidavit of Ms. Ripple, found at page 188 of the Globe Appendix. And the third is the findings of fact of the second Board of Bar Examiners. This is what Dr. Spire says. In 1988, at the end of the 11th grade, Mrs. Ripple was employed as a car hop at the A&W Root Beer Stand. A cash drawer discrepancy led to her termination there. She was charged in the incident, Mrs. Ripple believes, because her probation officer did not like her, blah, blah, blah. In the findings of fact on page A101, the board found the applicant was discharged from employment in 1988 for a cash drawer discrepancy, which discharge she blamed on her probation officer. And then I read her affidavit, and it's seemingly totally contradictory to both of those statements. As a car hop, I carried cash with me. I recall having received a $50 bill. There was a discrepancy. I'll start off. There was a discrepancy, which I reported at the end of my shift. I voluntarily brought the discrepancy to the attention of my manager and discussed it with him. She concludes, after discussing the matter, my manager and I concluded that the bill may have dislodged or blown away at some point. While I was scolded for being sloppy and inattentive, I was not charged or formally disciplined. What's the truth here? Was she charged?
The board did not find she was charged. The board found she was terminated.
Well, Spire said that she was charged.
Well, Spire said that Ripple said that. Spire is reporting statements made to him by Ripple. He has obviously
well, no personal knowledge. Well, they also said she blamed the discharge on her probation officer.
Right.
That's where does that appear, other than in the board's findings? She certainly didn't say it.
Here's in Spire's report.
But Spire's report says she was charged in the incident because her probation officer did not like her. Well, she wasn't charged in the incident, so, I mean, that seems
to cast... We don't know for sure whether she was charged or not. I'm just saying that...
Well, she says she wasn't.
Well, she said she was, too. There are two contradictory statements, both coming from her.
Where did she say that she was charged?
She said that to Dr. Spire.
So she said one thing to Dr. Spire and another thing in an affidavit to the bar.
That's correct.
Is it possible that the doctor simply misunderstood what she was saying? Because there is no evidence that she was on probation, juvenile, or otherwise at the time. She was under the supervision of the juvenile court, but in connection with the family difficulties she was having, not because of a juvenile delinquency adjudication. I don't think there's any evidence of that, right? So is it possible that he just misunderstood? And that's the most logical.
If that is a possibility, that's a possibility that it was up to Ms. Ripple to deal with because she's got the burden of proof. If there's some question here, it was up to her to resolve it. It was not up to the board to on its own dig up evidence disputing one or the other of her statements.
And in that same context, you're saying it was up to them to call Dr. Spear?
No, it was up to Ms. Ripple. Them, by them, do you mean
up to the
Ms. Ripple? Yes, it was up to Ms. Ripple to call Dr. Spear if she wanted to sort out or clarify any of the statements that were in his report. It was not up to the board. The board does not have the burden of persuasion here.
What about the fact that the board's second opinion issued after the hearing was identical in all material respects to the first opinion?
I think what that shows is that the board simply discounted all of the evidence that Ms. Ripple presented as being essentially irrelevant to the concerns that it had.
You don't think it suggests an erroneous exercise of discretion to the extent that this was a discretionary call because it references, I mean, it reveals no exercise of discretion, essentially, other than the reissuing of a previous opinion?
Oh, I think it does evidence of an exercise of discretion. What it does not specifically evidence is it does not specifically evidence a specific consideration of the evidence that Ms. Ripple presented at the evidentiary hearing. But it goes through a lot of facts before coming to the conclusion that Ms. Ripple did not show sufficient worthiness to be admitted to the bar.
All it does is repeat the prior findings with no reference to the new evidence that the board had received whatsoever. There's just a conclusory statement. We've reviewed it. We reissue. I mean, basically, that's all it is. It's a reissuance of the old opinion, suggesting that the entire hearing was a sham.
Well, that's what Ms. Ripple intends, but on the other hand, the board was sitting there, the board... evidence.
But, you know, from our perspective, reviewing what it did, it says nothing about its evaluation of the evidence that was presented at the hearing for us to review. And so if we're reviewing this either under a de novo or an abuse of discretion.
Let's assume that we didn't have that first decision, the initial decision. If this were the only decision of the board, I don't think you could complain about it.
But that's not what we have. We have the simple reissuance of a decision after a hearing,
and
which is identical in all material respects.
Yeah, and what that shows, or what that can reasonably be construed to show, is that the board simply didn't find any of the evidence worth even commenting on.
So that's the board saying we don't
find credible what Judge Fiedler says. We don't find credible what Judge Faust says. We don't find credible what Judge DeChambeau says. We don't find credible what these attorneys say.
I don't think that's a question of credibility. I think this is a question of relevance, credibility.
Okay, we don't give it any weight.
Right.
We give it no weight whatsoever.
Her testimony, her evidence, simply doesn't address our concerns. And because her evidence doesn't address the concerns that we voiced in our initial decision, we're just going to reiterate the initial decision.
And isn't that tantamount to saying she can never be a lawyer in this state? Because it's never going to, I mean, other than the passage of time, her evidence is not going to get any better, right?
No, not necessarily. Not necessarily. That's not true. Her evidence can get better. There is a way that it definitely can get better.
The passage of time was good behavior.
Well, one of the board's principal concerns here deals with the personality disorder that was diagnosed by Dr. Spear.
Did he actually make an affirmative diagnosis of a personality disorder or just suggest that her personality profile perhaps showed some characteristics? He did not make a DSM-IV concrete diagnosis of personality disorder, did he?
I think he did.
Well, what is the personality disorder?
Where is it in the report?
It's on page A217. Third paragraph down.
I think he did. I think he starts out by saying that she's got a personality disorder, and this is why I think his language leaves something to be desired. I grant you that. He didn't specifically say I have diagnosed her with a personality disorder.
Why don't we just read this? This is after he says she's bright, capable, well-developed intellect, analytical thinker, can reason well, manifest strong determination and zeal, ability to pursue personal and intellectual interests, reflect a high level of tenacity, etc. Then he goes on to say, she developed an interpersonal style that was guarded, cautious, and distrustful. Her relationship with her adoptive parents was superficial, and she turned to her peers for attention and recognition. Probably not too unusual for many people. Then he says, Miss Ripple has developed a personality structure whose centerpiece includes a self-protective, cautious, and distrustful style, a lack of interpersonal warmth or closeness, and a distinct propensity to repress or forget painful and discordant memories. Consequently, she has developed a rebellious and unconventional persona, in which she often reacts impulsively and with self-protective anger. There's no evidence to suggest the presence of an underlying psychotic or organic disorder. As a history of depression is consistent with the findings, this fits the diagnostic category of major depression recurrent.
Yeah. Am I reading the wrong place? You're not going to find it. There is no diagnosis of a personality disorder. It's just not there.
Let me refer you to page 11 of my brief, in which I cite page S12 of the record, in which Dr. Spire stated that a number of factors, which he specifically delineated, and this is a quote, strongly suggest a diagnosis of a personality disorder.
But sometimes precursors to the later development of an adult personality disorder is what I see, is the closest he gets to that, and which the conduct of her adult life since all of these episodes on which he bases that opinion contradicts, right? She got through law school. She's managing editor of the Law Review. She's worked for some...
No, I don't think
very
that contradicts it at all.
Exacting employers.
I don't think that contradicts it at all. Because what her evidence shows is that she is a very bright, capable person. That doesn't address the board's concerns. The board has never questioned her capability. It's never questioned her intelligence. It's never questioned her ability to do legal work. What the board has questioned is essentially her ability to get along with clients, to get along with lawyers, to get along with her peers in a situation in which she would be the primary attorney, primarily responsible for handling a case, not just a clerk working for someone else. That's the board's concern.
Right, counsel, just so, and if this is part of the record, I was referring to, this is the...
Counsel, have I, excuse me, Justice Wilcox, have I done something wrong by reading what I did into this record? Because if I did, I do apologize, and I don't want others on the bench to do that either.
I have no problem.
Well, I'll ask Mr. Van Sicklen, so my apologies to you and your client. Is it your position that this should not be read from the bench? Okay.
Now, I hadn't intended to read this, but I wanted to, I referred to the page so that counsel, I'm talking about the report that all of the court received as well as opposing counsel. It's on A217. It is the third paragraph. It hasn't, that's what I was referring to that I thought you took your material from in your brief to this court.
We both counsel relied on Dr. Spire's report, no question about it, to a very large extent. I mean, Dr. Spire's report has about 90% of the evidence on which the board relied in this case.
Counsel, let me tell you what's bothering me, okay? You have a young woman who has had difficulties. Juvenile difficulties at home, difficulties after reaching the age of a majority. Best not to have difficulties. Best not to get parking tickets, although we all get them. It's best not to have a misdemeanor theft charge. It's best not to be fired because there may or may not have been a problem with money. But then you've got somebody who goes to school, has a good record, and has a good work record, has people vouching for this good record. And in our system of justice, we recognize that people can change, and that people can be rehabilitated, and that people can work through their difficulties, and that they're given second, third, fourth, and fifth chances to make good. And what is it about this record that would indicate to the board that she can't make good? I don't know anyone that has a perfect personality, that doesn't offend at times, that isn't self-protective or distrustful, or any other number of adjectives or adverbs. So what is it that makes the board, this is on the basis of the record, say that we haven't overcome earlier problems?
It is the fact that she still has these personality problems as of the time that Dr. Spearer did his examination, coupled with the fact that these personality problems have manifested themselves throughout her life in antisocial conduct, thefts, the problems that she had with her roommates, the problems that she's had with the police, and just a litany of things from the time that she was 13.
And what about the time since the entrance of law school? Have we had a manifestation?
Two, since the time she entered law school. One was the wall wallpapered with parking tickets, which to the board reasonably suggested a disregard for the law. And the
you heard that expression before? I've got enough paper to paper my walls.
I've heard
enough
that expression,
tickets.
Yes.
Okay. All right. You used it?
Suggests to me the same thing it suggests to the board, and that is that the person doesn't have much regard for the law.
Might it also just suggest a sense of humor?
Or a
disregard for the law, but that's but one.
Or a cliche. Maybe that's the worst offense, that is using a cliche.
I'm sorry, I didn't quite hear you.
That the worst offense may be that she used a cliche.
No, I think the worst offense was that she got all those parking tickets.
Okay.
How many parking tickets did she get?
Well, we don't know quantitatively, but it was enough to walk
her along. What's bothersome to me is
if that, in addition to the other incident in 1998, the ordinance violation involving a law enforcement, for which she paid a forfeiture, bothersome to me is the imprecision that I see here. A statement taken, made, and I don't know how it was made, but, and that statement would be a basis for denying admission. That and this ordinance violation in the last 6 years. Maybe I just hang around with the wrong people, you know? But
I won't comment on that.
Don't comment on that. That's right.
But,
and none of us take personal offense.
I just have difficulty. I don't know why. And with high school, you know, many of these things were in high school and college, and it just seems out of proportion. But what am I missing here? There must be something I'm missing.
It's not any one of these incidents, and I grant you that any one of these incidents taken by itself is probably pretty petty, and would certainly not in and of itself warrant a denial of admission to the bar. But it's the cumulative effect of all of these things, one right after another. Bang, 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 bang.
But you could only point to two recently, and one of them is this statement, if I may follow up Justice Bradley's, about wallpapering the wall. Without apparently any investigation, the board took that statement literally, which would literally mean thousands of, or at least hundreds, of parking tickets.
Well, that's really
now, I have heard that, I have used that expression, I have heard it used, you know, to indicate 5 or 10 tickets. And as she has stated, as Ms. Ripple has stated, this was a facetious comment made in passing to Dr. Spire. Now, that, I don't know what the statement that you used, but there, what was it about? There's just not a sloppiness, but a, boy, I mean, if the board's going to depend on that, they should at least find out how many parking tickets were issued.
Well, again, I point out that the burden of proof here is on the applicant. And if there were some question about how many parking tickets she really got when she said, I had enough to wallpaper a wall, it was up to her to present evidence to say, no, when I made that statement, I was referring to the fact that I only got 5 or 10. But since that statement was never clarified, I think the board...
Oh, I think it was clarified. I think she clarified it, did she not? It's been a long time since I read her affidavit, but I think she clarified it, and she said that she used it totally...
As a
means of dropping some humor into her. It's somewhere in here, Mr. Ballesteri. I know that. She clarified.
She said it was a joke. She said it was a joke. No question about that.
Well, then, isn't it incumbent upon the board to find out whether it was a joke or whether there was a literal wallpapering of the walls,
no.
If they're going to depend on it?
No, that's not up to the board. That's the whole...
But Mr. Balistrieri, the issue really is not how many parking tickets she got. The issue is her attitude to the law. Isn't that the point? Right. And the board has taken the position that when you say you're gonna, you've got enough to wallpaper the wall, to paper the wall, that's an attitude of disregard of the law.
She's a very cavalier attitude towards the law.
And that's what their objection is.
That's what they're concerned.
So on the basis of that statement, cavalier attitude to the law, plus prior difficulties close enough to the law, that's enough to make the board concerned about her future, because that's what the concern here is, right? Whether in the future the board can predict how she's going to behave.
Well, it's not a question of whether the board can predict how she's going to behave. It's a question of, I think, more a question of whether the board is unable to predict with any degree of certainty that she's going to behave as a lawyer should behave.
That's what I meant. That's fine. So it's a question on the basis of past conduct, can you predict with some certainty future behavior?
Past conduct coupled with a present diagnosis of this personality disorder, which together certainly raise some questions about whether this...
No reference to the DIS for a personality disorder. Didn't I say it right? Isn't it DIS? Yeah, okay.
Yeah. And totally ignoring, apparently totally ignoring the affidavit of the psychiatrist that she did spend a great deal of time with, who completely contradicted Dr. Spryer.
Well, I point out two things. First of all, the law is well settled that when you have a conflict of experts, particularly on mental condition, it's up to the trier of fact to determine which expert it chooses to believe and whose opinion it decides to accept. I also point out this, that the record shows that the two psychiatrists, or the two mental health experts who examined Ms. Ripple, did so for very different reasons. The mental health expert that Ms. Ripple was seeing while she was in college was treating her only for depression, not for any of these other problems. And we have no reason to believe from this record that the mental health expert who treated her in college was even aware of many of these earlier difficulties, was aware of her record. We don't know that. That hasn't been explained. So there's a very reasonable basis for the board to rely on Dr. Spearer rather than the other expert.
What do you think this court should do about Mr. Balistrieri?
I was concerned that you were going to ask that question.
No, I'd get to it sooner or later, right?
Yeah, and I'm not sure that I'm in a really good position to answer your question, because I do represent the board here. I'm not, you know, you see me very often representing the state, where as the representative of the state, I can make a representation, and I'm not sure that I can do that in this case. I will say this. I would be willing to say this, however. I concede that the record shows unequivocally that she does have a history of being able to function quite well in circumstances where she is not the person who is primarily responsible for handling a case and where she's operating under the supervision of another attorney who is the primary person responsible for handling the case. Again, this is a situation where I don't think the board feels it has authority to issue a restricted license. I mean, I know that there are other examining boards who do that all the time. I don't see why there's any reason that this court can't do it. And I think that given the constraints of the fact that I represent a board that doesn't apparently doesn't have the authority to do that and has certainly not expressed an opinion on that. I think that's about as far as I can go in saying what I think ought to be done in this case.
Thank you, Mr. Balistrieri. Any other questions? Mr. Van Sicklin? I'm going to ask you, too, what you think the court should do, but go ahead with your argument.
Okay. I'm going to jump around a little bit. First, I think Heather has the right to overcome. I think that right is reflected in the administrative reg that governs here, BA 6.03. She should be really the poster girl, the testament of proof of that. Through hard work, she's overcome a difficult childhood as a foster child. And she's done it on her own through her own hard work. Next, Dr. Nielsen, I disagree with Mr. Balistrieri. I think he's not as familiar with the record. Dr. Nielsen did directly look at these facts and critique Dr. Spear's report and said she disagreed with his report, drew different conclusions. She basically said, as I would, his report isn't really nearly as bad as the board would crack it up to be. So this isn't a situation where Dr. Nielsen was unfamiliar with the issues. She addressed in her affidavit exactly the issue that's here. Next, I want to talk a little bit about, he indicated, well, you know, Ms. Ripple and her counsel got this second report at the hearing. That's not true. The record demonstrates that. If you look at my appendix at A165, at the end of the proceeding, I make a big to-do about the fact that she's been denied due process by this second report. I demand it. I don't get it, as reflected there. You then look at A201, which is my post-hearing, after the hearing, brief.
Would you think then we should send it back? Is that
I would hope that we could resolve this without that further delay. If that's what the court's result is, that's better than an affirmance, obviously, and we're happy for anything, but I really believe, Your Honor, that this is a case that ought to be reversed flat out. But again, if you look at A201 and A203, you'll see that even after the hearing, when I wrote my brief that was permitted, I didn't have that report yet.
Mr.
It wasn't until later that we got mailed the report by order of the board to its administrator.
Mr. Van Sicklin, I want you to clarify for me, if you can, this A&W incident, because to me, sometimes little things are most indicative of the whole. She says, I voluntarily quit in order to take another job. This is the A&W. And while I was scolded for being sloppy and inattentive, I was not charged or formally disciplined. The board says, the applicant was discharged from employment in 1988 for a cash drawer discrepancy, which discharge she blamed on her probation officer. Which statement is the truth?
First statement, Your Honor, and she said it twice, and I pressed her because we got Dr. Spear's report, and I said, you know, where did this come from? And it's a, frankly, just a misreport by him, as Justice Sykes pointed out. And in her affidavit and in her direct testimony at the hearing, which in the board was there available to ask questions of her, she explained it. And
so she was never charged.
She's never charged.
Never disciplined, and no probation officer ever entered the picture.
Right. And certainly, the board's investigator looked under every rock here in her past, and if there was any evidence of a criminal proceeding, we would have seen it in spades, Your Honor.
Okay, so the point is that that's a clear misstatement. That's what you're saying, that they made, the board either made a mistake, or they, Dr. Spear, made the error when she supposedly self-reported that.
It's a perfect example of one of the things that I think the board should have addressed in its decision from the hearing. What is this court to review if you can't see how the board exercised its discretion? Why have the hearing if we don't know what weight they gave this testimony and so forth? Now,
I think that,
this business of this we're talking about this car. It's like an 8 or 9 year old stock. She had a job, she worked hard, she bought a used car. To turn this into some kind of a misrepresentation or whatever the board's trying to twist it into is I think, just a witch hunt, this whole thing. Mr. Balistrieri says, well, the board didn't ignore all of the testimony and affidavits. It just discounted all the evidence carte blanche. Again, I think You got to weigh it, and you have to show how you exercise your discretion. Otherwise, what's the point of having this hearing? Why did we bring in all these witnesses to talk? One last point. I want to talk about relevance. He just cavalierly dismisses all the evidence that we tried to put in that hearing on the grounds that it's really not relevant what judges who worked with Heather thought, or her employers, or her professors, or any of that. What's really relevant here is what our private eye dug up from her past. And I just think that misses the mark. I think there has to be some relevance, some weight accorded to what this woman has accomplished and what people say about her in law-related jobs over her adult life. And for the board just to say it's not relevant, we don't even need to comment on it, I think is inappropriate.
Do you think that the experience indicates that okay to work in an environment where you're supervised, but not necessarily when you're the lead lawyer? I mean, that's what we've been given as one inference that you can draw.
I don't think you can draw that inference fairly, Your Honor. If you look at the testimony and the affidavits of these very qualified experts, managing partners in law firms, professors, judges, they don't put any qualifications. Judge DeChambeau is willing to hire her tomorrow. They don't say it's some kind of a ministerial junior role. Ms. Schwann, she basically was to Bill Friday in running a small office divorce practice for a very busy practitioner and handled all aspects of it, money, client meetings, and the like. There was no restrictions placed on her, and there's no basis in the record to think they're necessary. Would that be better than nothing? Sure, but I would hope it's not necessary, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Van Sicklen, and thank you, Mr. Balistrieri. That ends the...